I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The film Meditation Park opens shortly and has already gotten a Canadian Screen Award nomination for one of its actors, Si Ma. He plays Bing, whose wife Maria, played by Cheng Pei-Pei, who we meet hanging the laundry and keeping house for him. They're in their 60s, and soon after she finds a thong in her husband's pants pocket. She's forced to confront how powerless she is. It soon sets her on an unexpected journey of liberation. Joining me now is Mina Shum, the acclaimed director of the film, to talk about the film she's written, directed, and produced. The film also stars Sandra Oh, Don McKellar, and Zach Santiago, with Jimmy Chen, Lillian Lim, Alana Ong, Charmaine Yeo, and Leanne Balaban. The film screened at last year's Toronto International Film Festival to much acclaim, and it opened the Vancouver International Film Festival. Mina Shum is the acclaimed director of feature films, shorts, and documentaries. Her previous films include Double Happiness, Drive, She Said, Long Life, Happiness and Prosperity, and Ninth Floor. At Mina Shum is the Twitter handle. The film opens in Vancouver and Toronto on the 9th of March. It's a great film. It's moving and funny. Set in Vancouver. It's got a lot of heart. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program, Mina Shum. Ms. Shum, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for joining us. This is great to talk to you because, as I was telling you just before we started, I love the film. The thing that strikes me as the film starts is this smile that Maria has.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to describe it. There's a sense of satisfaction on her face.
Mm-hmm.
But then we learn later on just how that's superficial as most smiles might be.
Mm-hmm.
When we first meet Maria and we meet Bing, where are they sort of in their marriage and in their relationship?
I think on the surface they're very satisfied. Mm-hmm. I mean, Maria is very satisfied. That smile is genuine at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
She is. Like, I see in my city the grandmothers who take their kids to school, their grandkids to elementary school.
Yeah.
You know, they walk by my house, and they seem like the most happiest people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've raised one generation, and they're just serving the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And servitude often is a very satisfying place to be because you're selfless.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what Maria's feeling at the beginning. She's like, this is it, man. He's 65. I've got grandchildren. We have our life. I feel like I've achieved. And certainly Bing is, on the surface, seems to be saying the same thing, but actually he's hiding the truth.
Yeah. So. And that, of course, unravels through the course of the movie.
Okay.
The thing that I noticed at the end of the movie is the smile then that she has is a much fuller smile, if you will.
She owns it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's something about the film is this sort of trajectory that we see Maria. Do you know a lot of women like this?
Like what?
Like the have the experiences that Maria has had?
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly the inspiration for the film came from, it was like a few years ago. There was many family members, friends, who, I don't know what was going on, but there was a spat of infidelity.
Mm.
And the reaction amongst some of my family members was not to say anything. That to disrupt the home would not serve the kids, that there's a certain amount of, there's a deference to the husband that knows no bounds.
Mm-hmm.
And also knowing that to serve the family might best be to let him just get through this. And so that was very shocking to me because in my, like, you know, my contemporaries, my westernized girlfriends, they'd be like, get out of there.
Right.
Go to therapy. Or do you want an open relationship? Like, you know, there's a whole different set of choices, right? So the fact to make no choice, to have no choices, that to me was very foreign, but also completely understandable to me. So, and that was the nut of the story in a way. I wanted to explore a character who deliberately decided not to act.
Yeah, she does do some things, in the, without giving it away, she does do some things in the film that would I guess, confound people like you and me, you know, people of a different generation.
But because, I think, hopefully, because we're in her head so much, we understand all the choices she does make.
Yeah.
Or that she doesn't make.
Right, right.
Yeah.
She just seems like a fun, rich character. And my parents are Filipino, and I grew up in Vancouver. It's so great that you've decided to make her the center of the film.
Oh, yeah. It was important to me in terms of, it's a type of character I've never seen.
Yeah.
We never hear from. And yet.
We see, right?
We see all the time. So, why can I, as a Chinese woman, go to see Die Hard and completely invest myself as being Bruce Willis in the film?
Right.
So a Bruce Willis type person should be able to, if we are inclusive, if we are open, if storytelling is and cinema is powerful, we should be able to, no matter where you come from, if I've done my job correctly, get inside Maria's head and feel like we're Maria,
yeah,
regardless of color and gender and age, right? So that's really that's partly why I wanted to do it. Also, she had a world that was worth exploring. I just found it so fascinating that her world would be so small, and yet if she just stepped outside, there'd be a whole other experience waiting for her. In a way, it's her own fear that stops her from doing the things that she wants to be doing.
Yeah, and there's a whole world just even across the alley, right?
That's right, yeah.
And I mentioned that because that brings us to a few other characters, like the other ladies who sell parking.
The Popos, yeah.
Yeah, and Don McKellar's character, Gabriel, who lives across the street, who's also selling parking as well. Bing has a certain way of looking at these people, and especially Gabriel. But even the Popos, where does that come from? Is that something that, I mean, if you had to explain that to someone who, I mean, we want to know our neighbors, but I guess Bing doesn't, right?
Well, I think Bing, as a source of Bing's, as a source of his actions to his community is an arrogance. And that arrogance comes from fear. It is, you know, he thinks he's better than everyone because he's scared, I think. I think that's really the root of much of why people isolate from other people. They're just too afraid to make the first move. And so what was easy for Bing, and I certainly saw it in my own family's growth in Canada, my father's English wasn't great. Mm-hmm. So he would seem like the kind of guy who didn't want to make friends. And it was partly his own insecurity that fueled that. When you don't have language, it's a huge detriment to social interaction.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, Asian men, too, right? So there's that sort of, you know, we know everything. I'm going to protect you.
And don't even ask for help, right?
I won't ask for help.
Yeah.
That's right. Everything's private, right? They're all inside the family. So It's fascinating because it's like he's a victim to his own creation.
Yeah, there's some marvelous scenes in the film, and what I liked about them were these interactions between Maria, especially and Sandra Oh, who plays her daughter, but also the character of Gabriel, which is Don McKellar's character. These very tender, very quiet moments. As the director, and you'll pardon my questions, but I mean, how do you get your actors to do stuff like that?
Well, you start with great casting. So you cast it right. There's a saying in my business that if you cast it right and the script's good, 90% of your job's done.
Right.
But also it's creating a safe environment, setting the tone for what kind of film this is going to be. And it's certainly, we talked a lot about the characters individually with each. I had meetings with each actor. And then we also had a day of rehearsals where instead of reading the script, we actually did improvs and games to solidify relationships.
Mm.
So for instance, one of the Don McKellar rehearsal moments, which was so great, was I had all the three Popoas in one side of the studio, rehearsal studio, and then I had Don in another corner, and my direction was very simply, you're selling parking, there's not a lot of business, and Popoas, please discuss Dawn in Chinese.
Yeah.
And so that just made, they just sort of own that together. There was I did a very simple non-verbal exercise with Dawn and Pepe where they sat across from each other and they just mirrored each other.
Mm.
So if somebody moved their hand up, the other, so that the energy flowed between them and you couldn't, the goal of the game, it's like improv 101 game.
Yeah.
It's like if you went to theater school, it's one of the first things you're taught is this mirror exercise. And the goal in it is to not know who's leading by the end. For me, not to know. And so that trust was sort of stitched in very, very early. And then, you know, then you have dinners, then you have meals, then you have downtime on set. And all of it is building towards these performances. They were amazing.
Yeah.
I'm so lucky.
Yeah, there's one scene in particular. Again, I don't want to give it away, but where Don has to do something quite emotional,
mm-hmm.
and it's amazing to me because you don't see his face at all, and it's buried in Maria,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they're in the alley hugging each other,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yet you know exactly what he's going through without even looking at his face.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you don't even see her face at that point either.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I guess that's a trust that you all build on set there, right? As the director,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The music as well is quite remarkable in the film. I mean, there's Marvel musical choices there.
Oh, thank you.
Was that something that you wanted early on? That you wanted the film to sound the way it does?
Oh yeah. I mean, actually, it's funny because the first person I sent the script to from a creative, collaborating, non-cast perspective was
mm-hmm.
Craig, I sent it to Craig Berkey, who was my sound designer on this film. He is the sound designer. He's been nominated for 4 Oscars, I think.
Mm.
He's the sound designer for No Country for Old Men, Tree of Life, and Hannah. And I had seen those films and not known it was the same designer.
Mm.
But I had heard something common in the sound design. Like, those are films I go to in terms of when I want to show people, this is what sound design can do emotionally for a character. And so I sought him out. It turned out he lived in Vancouver. And we started discussing how Maria hears, depending on what she's feeling.
Mm.
So that was stitched into the sound design very early. And then I was going to work with Andrew Lockington, a composer I've worked with before on Long Life, Happiness, and Prosperity. And he's since gone on to very big Hollywood movies. Like, he did San Andreas and Percy Jackson films.
Uh-huh.
But he also wanted to bring Maria to life. He'd never seen a story like this. And so our goal with the score is, I said, I hear an epic score. I want her to be a superhero.
Yeah.
I want to take people who don't even think about Maria, I want them to feel her like she is the Bruce Willis character in Die Hard.
Yeah.
Like that her choices are as epic. And so I thought the music really actually brought a lot to our goal was to bring more shades of Maria to the audience.
The other thing that I noticed too was the set design, especially their house.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a house that we've all seen, but some of us may have lived in houses like that. It's an older
mm-hmm.
house,
mm-hmm.
but inside it looks very modern, especially the kitchen.
Yes.
Is that a real house or was that a set?
No, it's a real house. It's a real house that reminded me of houses, many houses of family members.
Yeah.
So it's actually really funny because we scouted, I think that was our eighth house we looked at. Like, you know, there's 10 of us in a van driving from place to place. We got into this house and none of us would leave. Like the creative team was just like walking around. We started talking shots and my director of photography, Peter Wunstorf, said, I guess this is the house. I was like, yeah, I guess so. When no one wants to leave.
Yeah.
We found the house and we redecorated it. All that wallpaper from the film in the film is, actually, based on some graphic designs my father had brought from Hong Kong to Canada when he came. It was a series of prints that I gave to Jason Sutherland, my production designer, and I said, do you think we can make wallpaper out of these? And he just went crazy. He was like, these are, they're of that era of when you would, in the 60s of immigration, much of the design. So it really had that authenticity in it because of that, I think.
Yeah. The other thing, I realized this as watching your films, all of your fictional films,
mm-hmm.
have all been set in Vancouver. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's really great to see the city that I've grown up in film as you've depicted it. What do you think this film says about the Vancouver that we're living in, especially in these times where it's changing quite rapidly?
Well, in my own backyard, what I see is a desire for social interaction. Yes, we all have our own personal computers, right, that are in our hands now.
Yeah.
But we're craving for connection. I can't believe how many community events happen in my neighborhood constantly. I've been to, like, parades in the snow. I've been to block parties in the rain. We're singing to the apple trees, you know. I know my neighbors. I may not know their names, but I know if there was an earthquake, we'd be there for each other.
Right.
You know, there's. I think as we're all feeling powerless and feeling poor in our growing city, and in some ways invisible, there's a real desire for connection because that all we have is each other.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can. Yeah, I made some movies. I'm not hugging those when I'm on my deathbed. I'm hugging the people who are close to me. I'm remembering those memories, right?
Yeah.
That's what's the most important thing. And I see that when I look outside.
Yeah. What keeps you in Vancouver? Because, I mean, you've been able to work elsewhere. You've grown up here, and you're able to work here. I mean,
it's my muse.
Yeah.
I consider Vancouver my muse. It's like I can work here. It's close to LA. It's not that close to Toronto. Unfortunately, I have to go there a lot because that's where the money and the power is in this business.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the mix of people here. That I love. I even say I love the tension because it's real.
Yeah.
You know, like my city makes me laugh in that, you know, Gregor Robertson tried to do a new logo for the city and people freaked out.
Right, right.
You know, like we care that much, right?
Yeah.
Like we're all suddenly art graphic critics, right? And guess what? He decided to stand down, right? So there is that agent, a bit of agency here. Like, we feel there's a collective agency. You know, why am I in Vancouver? My family, my friends, and the food. I gotta say.
Yeah.
I love being able to swim in the ocean, all that stuff, all the cliches, right? I love that it's a walkable city, a bikeable city. I've never felt at home anywhere else as I do here. So.
And the other thing that you do is in this film is the neighborhood in which they live in is a neighborhood that I think a lot of us have forgotten over the years because, you know, the Canucks have ceased to play there.
Mm.
Yet it's a remarkable looking part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it you know, you see everything in that part of the world. You see the mountains, you see the ocean, the water. and all this concrete, and I mean, it looks beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I've set all three of my fiction films in that area.
Yeah.
Because to me, it's the perfect set design to magnify how small us humans are in relation to nature. We've got this gorgeously built, one of the first ports in Canada, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, you put it up against the mountains and the ocean, it's puny. And to me, that is the existential angst that we live with, right? Like, we can rail with our technology, we can rail with our perceived power, but really, we're just little people. Thor would take his hammer and just smash us, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, and knowing that, there's something to be celebrated there. It isn't just a bummer. It's like, there's something about being that we are humans in a much bigger place,
yeah.
and something that we don't fully understand. That to me, it feeds me. Like, I actually look out into that landscape. I live in the neighborhood, and it feeds me every day. I just go, I'm feeling puny, and at the same time, like, I'm meant to do something here.
So the film's played at a couple film festivals already, and it'll be in wider release March 9th.
Mm-hmm.
What's the reaction been from say audiences in terms of just the power, the agency of this character Maria?
I've had some beautiful responses where I'll never forget this at the TIFF screen premiere, the very first time I've screened it with an audience, and you know it's working. That three South Asian women came up to me crying at the end of the film. They wanted to they had tears in their eyes. They wanted to have their photo taken with me and Pei-Pei. And then they just said that this was their story, that they'd never seen their community. Even though they're not Chinese, right? Mm-hmm. And they were 30. The women were 30 that were coming up to me. They weren't 60. Mm-hmm. And yet they felt like they were being recognized in a way that they'd never been seen before. So that to me is like that's beyond story. That's actually like the whole idea is like creating some sort of empower. I want people to feel empowered in a powerless world, right?
Yeah.
And for those, that energy and those women to actually be so candid with me, that was such a gift. It makes me feel like that I'm doing something right. that I'm being, that the stories are of some service.
Yeah, and you just imagine just the people watching this even, how it might inspire some young person to want to make a film about their own mom or their own grandmother later on.
Yeah, or themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
When I have directors on, I always ask them about the films that they watched, say, growing up or at a young age that influenced them. Are there some that come to mind right now?
Well, the film that really sparked me from to go, I want to be a filmmaker, was a film by Peter Weir called Gallipoli.
Mm.
An Australian film. I think I saw it in like 1989, no, probably 86, mm-hmm. something like that. And it was one of the first sort of art house films I'd ever seen, where it told a very intimate story, in a very grand setting. And it wasn't your Hollywood movie. It wasn't a genre film. It was a drama. And something about that, the fact that they were Australian with funny accents, all of that led me to go, there is a cinema where I can put my stories in, where the people don't, it isn't all Hollywood, it isn't all genre, that there's a place for the little story inside the epic story. That was one of the first films I saw that sort of changed that for me.
Yeah. And is it something that you watch regularly, if you will?
The film?
Yeah.
No, it's not a film I watch regularly.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how even though you don't, it has a, it stays in your head, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm a great admirer and fan of your work, and this has been fun to talk to you today. I wish you every success with this run, and I do hope. I mean, I watched the movie on my computer, but this is a movie that everyone should see on the big screen.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, come out March 9th.
Indeed. Thank you, Mina. Meditation Park opens in Vancouver and Toronto the 9th of March. And of course, check your local listings if you're in a city other than those two. Do see it. It's a great, great film. It's director Mina Shum joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.